All right. I want to thank our sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, that makes this lecture series possible for us. And tonight we're going to hear from Dr. Michael Latz, and he's going to talk about bioluminescent animals in the deep sea. Some of you were here to hear Edie Witter's talk. She talked about bioluminescence. You're going to hear a quite different approach tonight. This one is Michael talks about mechanisms. He's a marine biologist at the University of California, San Diego, Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He's been there for 30 years. He directs the LATS laboratory. And he's been studying bioluminescence for more than 30 years. His research interests include using interdisciplinary approaches involving biology, chemistry, and physics to investigate how marine animals interact with their environment. And he also is very interested, though, in not only contributing to the body of scientific knowledge, but to transforming and transitioning that knowledge to the public in ways that they can understand and grasp its importance. He's interested in the ecological role of bioluminescence, the cellular regulation of light emission, and the applications of bioluminescence as a tool in oceanography and engineering. Recently, he's been studying bioluminescent bays in the Caribbean, and he works there with local conservation groups to better understand the dynamics of these systems. There are very important drivers of ecotourism, but you have to be very careful, or the ecotourists can love them to death and you lose some of the beauty that attracts them there in the first place. He manages an artist-in-residence program at the LATS laboratory at Scripps, giving artists the opportunity to work with him on bioluminescence or other projects. He worked on an exhibit with an artist that was in Paris, and he's going to be doing something on the Santa Monica Pier in September with bioluminescent organisms. He grew up on Long Island, New York. That's an amazing laboratory for anyone who's interested in coastal marine environments, because you have a greater diversity of coastal marine environments there in a small geographic area than any place else in the United States and maybe in the world. He got his bachelor's degree with high honors from Duke with a major in zoology, and then he went on to get a PhD from University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're hoping that we're going to be able to collaborate with Michael in the future and do a project together. We would like to, none of us has ever seen a really good exhibit on plankton. Everybody, all of us know what plankton are and why they're important, but nobody has ever succeeded in bringing the magic alive. And Michael was just telling me one of the ways maybe is to use bioluminescence to draw people in and to introduce them to this world, which drives much of what happens in the ocean. So please join me in welcoming Michael Latz.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for everyone who's here and watching online. I want to dedicate my talk tonight to those who are no longer with us, including the 3,000 who perished some 12 years ago today. So the image you're looking at here is not mist swirling on the base of the mountains, but it's actually a time exposure of bioluminescence from the Caribbean. Bioluminescence on land is relatively rare, but in the ocean there's a wide diversity of organisms that produce light. And they're doing it for a number of reasons: to find food, to find mates, and to protect themselves from predators. And they use an incredibly diverse set of behaviors and displays to accomplish this. In fact, in the deep sea, most of the animals residing there are bioluminescent, because signaling in an environment that's completely dark is very effective. So you're seeing here in this video, which is actually taken by Edie Witter, a number of displays of bioluminescence. And so what I want to do tonight is share with you some of the animal organisms that do this, talk about some things of interest to us locally here in Southern California, and talk about some of my recent projects that Jerry alluded to. So, there's a wide diversity of luminescent organisms, and shown here are just several examples. Here are glowing bacteria plated on a petri dish. This is a dinoflagellate producing light. Dinoflagellates are common members of the phytoplankton that are responsible for local red tides that are luminescent. This shows a deep sea copepod that squirts out bioluminescence to protect itself from predators. This is a deep sea coral. Most corals, especially the reef building corals, are not luminescent, but there are some examples of deep living corals that have very recently been shown to be bioluminescent. I'll talk about anglerfish using bioluminescence to attract prey. This is a worm, a polychaete, that produces bioluminescent displays associated with mating swarms where the males are attracted to the females. This jellyfish represents a wide number of different kinds of jellyfish, especially in the deep sea, that produce bioluminescence. They do it to protect themselves from predators. This is a bottom view of a squid that uses bioluminescence for camouflage. So animals like these, there's also some fish and shrimp that live at mid depths in the ocean where the light is very dim. So it's not completely dark. It's the base of the light zone. And they have a problem that they are can be seen by their predators that are looking up and scanning for silhouettes. So they essentially fill in their shadow with bioluminescence to camouflage themselves. Here are flashlight fish, and they are exhibited here at the aquarium. They use their light as a flashlight to find food. And then there are a number of bottom living animals. Here is a brittle star that uses its bioluminescence to protect itself from predators. So these are just several examples to kind of get us started, and I'll certainly go into more details as we progress. So bioluminescence is produced as a result of a chemical reaction. And a great analogy is with light sticks. So you know with the light sticks, it doesn't start glowing until you break it, until you crack it, and you shake it up. Well, there's actually two chemicals in the light stick. And there, one of them is in a vial, a glass vial, and the other one, so when you break it, crack it, you're actually breaking the vial, allowing the two chemicals to mix. So one of the chemicals is then oxidized. The second chemical is like a catalyst to facilitate this reaction. But the one chemical is oxidized, releases energy, and that energy comes out as light. And so based on the chemistry, you can have different colors of light based on the makeup of the chemicals. This is similar to how bioluminescence works. There are two chemicals. One chemical is oxidized. It's called luciferin, and it's the substrate. It's the molecule that is oxidized. Oxidized releases energy, which comes out in the form of light. The second molecule is called luciferase, and it catalyzes this reaction. So for the chemist in the audience, here's a reaction, a generic reaction. And so it involves oxygen to oxidize the luciferin, releasing light. The most common color of the light of bioluminescence is in the blue-green. This is the color of light that transmits best through ocean water. What's interesting is that if you consider fireflies, which are obviously producing bioluminescence in air, they don't have a problem with absorption of light by water, so they can produce different colors and more longer wavelength colors, like into the yellow. And there are some beetles that produce even red bioluminescence. But these colors of light don't work well in the ocean because those colors are strongly absorbed by seawater. So blue-green is the best color for producing a light signal that will transmit through ocean water. So I mentioned anglerfish. So anglerfish produce light from this organ called an esca. It's the end of this modified fin ray. And they actually culture bacteria in this organ. and it's the bacteria that are producing the light for them. So the idea is that they're sitting quietly, and there's glowing from here, and dim glowing is an attractant. Just like if you want to go night fishing, you'll have a glowing lure. Glowing is an attractant to other animals. They come and they kind of check it out. Well, look where the eye is looking here, and the mouth is oriented this way, so they can pivot and strike at the animal that is attracted to the light. This anglerfish here is one we actually worked with on a ship. We collected it off the coast here, worked with it live, and notice the filaments here in the esca. So we did, you wouldn't want to do this with your finger, but if you take a pencil and you touch the esca, in the blink of an eye, it struck at that pencil. So they look like kind of sluggish fish, but they actually can respond really quickly. So anglerfish are ambush predators. Now you may have seen a depiction of them in the movies. Is that, oh, the light, it's so calming. You sport tropical fish in the deep sea. Really? And then there's this monster anglerfish that's chasing down these poor fish to try to get them. No. Anglerfish are not, they're not active chase down type of predators. They're ambush predators. They allow the prey to come to them and then they strike. Although I did like this movie. So then, flashlight fish. Flashlight fish also grow bacteria in these organs underneath the eyes. And that's where the light comes. So they actually culture them really well. And it's specialized structure to these organs to allow them to grow the bacteria. And even though they're always constantly emitting light, the fish have mechanisms to blink the light. So they can shutter the light so it appears on and then so it would be off and then turn it back on. And in this video here, which was taken from a former display at the Birch Aquarium, they no longer have flashlight fish on exhibit there, you'll notice that the light is blinking. And so it's thought that maybe they're using the light to communicate, but these fish live on deep reefs, places like in the Red Sea, and they come out under dark conditions, and they use the light to search for food. Flashlight fish. So, the trivia question, remember this, the largest luminescent animal on the planet is a deep sea squid called Tinningia, and it's a squid that's been observed a lot from dead specimens. This is a specimen that washed up on the beach in the Caribbean. It's 375 pounds. And so these are big squids. They're also known from the stomach contents of sperm whales, which feed almost exclusively on deep sea squids. And so this is a squid that we know about from dead specimens, mainly, and they have light organs on the end of two of their tentacles, and it's believed that they use them like searchlights to find food. They can rotate them and shine them around. So these squid have essentially, the adults have never been seen before live, but recently they were captured on video and still by a Japanese scientist, the one who was searching for the giant squid. And so this picture here shows a live Tinningia, which is attacking bait on a deep sea camera setup. And so now I want to show you video of, this is not a bioluminescence, but this is the squid approaching it. And trying to attack the camera. So one point I want to make here is that these squid are active, very active visual predators. They have large, well-developed eyes. There are many predators, like most predators in the deep sea, have large, well-developed eyes despite the complete absence of sunlight in this habitat. So what's the reason for very light-sensitive large eyes? Well, there is light in the deep sea, but it doesn't come from sunlight. It comes from bioluminescence. So there are visual predators in the deep sea that use bioluminescence to help them search out prey. So I don't know if anyone here has been to the deep sea. I would think not. It's sort of ironic because the deep sea is the largest habitat by volume on this planet. But I guess I'm on the only one in the room who's been down in a research submarine to see it. So it's not something that's accessible. So what I want to do is now turn away from the deep sea into more coastal habitats, of which we may have more familiarity. So now I want to talk about ostracods. These are crustaceans kind of loosely related to shrimp and crabs, and they produce bioluminescence to attract females. So these are all males that you're looking at. And here they are in a dish, and you'll notice that they squirt out the blue bioluminescence. They're kind of cute looking, and they are producing bioluminescence in these displays to attract females. So the way it works is that these ostracods live on shallow reefs in places like Panama, and you can actually go down and dive on this. You have to go at dusk, and because it's early nighttime when these displays, you see them. And what you'll notice is that there are puffs of light that move. And so in this kind of display, they're rising up from the bottom. So these are males that are swimming up and producing these puffs of light in a certain sequence. So the females don't do this. The females are sitting here in the sand, and during the day they're buried in the sand. They come out at night to do this. Females are watching these displays. The females don't answer back, like in fireflies, but then the females swim up and will intersect, anticipate where the next puff of light would be, because that's where the male is, and then they'll go for mating. So you can actually see these displays on shallow reefs in places like Panama. What's really interesting is that these are very conspicuous displays. If you're a predator of an ostracod, it would be really simple to go, okay, there's food, it's right there. But in fact, there's very little predation on the ostracods, and it's thought that the bioluminescence is like a warning signal to these animals, because if they try to eat the ostracods, the ostracods will spew out a whole lot of bioluminescence, which acts as a burglar alarm to make the fish predator more vulnerable. So if you're eating a luminescent critter, then you have to be careful that you're not triggering a light alarm that would make you vulnerable to your own predators. So now I'll turn to an area that I love, the dinoflagellates, which are common members of the phytoplankton. And not all dinoflagellates are luminescent, but there are maybe a dozen genera that are. This here is one species. It's about a millimeter in length, and essentially the bigger, the brighter. So this is a pretty bright one. And what you're looking at is this is the nucleus here. There are these strands that run through the cytoplasm of the cell. This cell exists in a cyst form, so there's a cell wall along the outside. Nice thing about dinoflagellates is that we've been able to culture them over the last 60 or so years, and so they're great experimental model organisms to work with in the laboratory, because you can culture them and do experiments. And so this is something that I've been doing a lot. And so in this picture here, this is a picture of me holding a culture flask, swirling it, and demonstrating the bioluminescence. And normally, if it was a little closer to San Diego, I'd bring up some live material to show you, but instead I just have to show you a video. So here I am swirling the flask. And then when I stop, then the light dies down. So in dinoflagellates, the bioluminescence is produced by the mechanical agitation. They're sensing the force in the fluid from that agitation, and then that triggers a whole sequence of events within the cell, ending up with a flash of light. So when they're doing this, they're oxidizing luciferin, and eventually, this is a loop, but in real life, if I kept on swirling it, eventually the bioluminescence would be exhausted, it would get dimmer, and eventually run out of luciferin to react. So then the light would be exhausted. So this shows that the bioluminescence comes from all these little discrete sources within the cell. So these are vesicles that contain the luciferin and the luciferase. They're distributed throughout the cell, and when the cell is mechanically agitated, then they're triggered to produce the bioluminescence, and there's a complex series of steps that result in this that I'm not going to go into those details here, but this is something that we're actively studying right now. So what's the function of dinoflagellate bioluminescence? Well, it acts to protect them from predators. So how does this work? Well, imagine a scenario that we're here just off the coast here, and here are the dinoflagellates. So this is all nighttime. So they have dinoflagellates. This represents a copepod, which is interested in eating the dinoflagellate, but it's grazing. It can't actually see the dinoflagellate. It's just sort of slowly swimming around, hoping to grab onto one to eat it. And then this represents a fish predator, which would love to eat that copepod, but it can't see it because it's nighttime. So the copepod just happens to bump into the dinoflagellate. It grabs the dinoflagellate to try to eat it, and that mechanical force is what triggers the flash of light by the dinoflagellate, and that flash of light then attracts this predator, which doesn't have any teeth in this depiction, but believe me, it wants to eat that copepod. So what happens is that the flash of light by the dinoflagellate is doing two things. First of all, that copepod gives a jump response when it sees the flash of light. And it's essentially a reflex to this light flash. And if it doesn't do that, then it has a greater chance of being eaten by its predator. And so the attraction to the predator is a burglar alarm. In this case, the dinoflagellate is the victim, and it's saying help, but it's a flash of light that's the alarm, and the copepod is the burglar, and then here this fish predator is the police, which is coming in this case to try to eat the burglar. So it's a burglar alarm scenario. So you may have seen the movie Life of Pi. There's this great scene, which of course is my favorite part of the movie, where it's nighttime and there's all this bioluminescence, and then the character, he takes his hand and he swirls it in the water, stimulating the bioluminescence, and then the whale comes, and it's beautiful, beautiful depiction. Of course, that's just made up. I want to talk to you about the reality. So we are lucky here in Southern California, we have occasions where we have red tides, where the abundance of dinoflagellate can be much higher than normal and can lead to discoloration of the water. So in this case, here's the blue water, the surfer, and this is produced, if it's a bioluminescent red tide, produced by large numbers of this dinoflagellate here called Lingolidinium polyhedrum, used to be called Goniolex, and here's a single cell. They are common members of our local phytoplankton. And for whatever reason, we still don't understand, they can get to very high numbers on occasion and cause spectacular displays of bioluminescence. And it needs to be agitated. So here we see agitation by the waves. This is a red tide in 2005. Now, 2 years ago, there was a massive red tide in Southern California. Maybe some of you had an opportunity to see it. And no, these videos aren't playing. So there are videos that you can actually search on YouTube. If you search for red tide bioluminescence, you'll see spectacular videos that show the bioluminescence from this red tide 2 years ago. And the first video shows a surfer actually surfing by Oceanside Pier. And you can see the blue light that's stimulated by the agitation from the surfboard as the wave is breaking. And you also see the discoloration of the water. It's kind of reddish, brownish water from the large numbers of the organisms. And you know, so, and then the second video shows the waves breaking off the beach. Really spectacular video by a San Diego videographer, Logan Call. So I encourage you to look at those. Sorry that this isn't working. And so you may ask, well, when's our next red tide? Well, turns out we're having a red tide right now in San Diego. And this appears to be a local phenomenon. This was, this photo is from September 2nd. And it's offshore San Diego showing these bands of discoloration. Hopefully you can all see that. This is discoloration from the large numbers of the dinoflagellates that have accumulated up at the surface during the day. They're attracted to sunlight because they're photosynthetic. So during the day, when it's sunlit, they'll swim up as close to the surface of the water as they can. So that's what you're seeing here. And then here's a photo I took from the Scripps Pier a day later, showing the intense coloration of the water from the dinoflagellates. So if there is a red tide, and it's the bioluminescent dinoflagellate, essentially you just have to find a dark beach. And then you can go there, you can observe the stimulation by the waves, you can go in the water and swim in it. These are not toxic organisms. I encourage you to participate in that. I don't know if anyone here has seen red tide bioluminescence here. So a number of you, it's something that you can do here locally. But if you really want to see spectacular bioluminescence, you have to go somewhere else. And this is Puerto Rico. So the thing about our local red tides is that, first of all, we can't predict when they're going to occur. And when they're here, we don't know how long they're going to last. We don't understand anything about them, about their dynamics. So it's kind of frustrating. If you want to study red tides and their bioluminescence, how do you prepare for that? And then when they happen, what, do you have to drop everything else you're doing? So it's really frustrating as a scientist to deal with this. But there are places, especially these bioluminescent bays in the Caribbean, where the bioluminescence, the dinoflagellate abundance is high enough so that there are displays of bioluminescence that are persistent throughout the year. And so it makes a great opportunity to go see some spectacular displays of bioluminescence. Anybody here gone to Puerto Rico, seen bioluminescent bays? So this is something that you can easily go on vacation and experience it. It's wonderful. So let me tell you a little bit about it. So the dinoflagellate in the Caribbean that produces the bioluminescence is related to our local red tide species, but it's tropical and not temperate. So it is a different organism. And the one thing I want to point out is that they produce cysts. And both of these species that I'm talking about produce cysts. Cysts is a life stage in which it's like a dormant life stage, sink down into the sediment, and then they can reemerge later. And so it's thought that the emergence of cells from the cysts, from the sediment, is one way in which you can see red tides. So it could be very important for initiating red tides and blooms. Okay, so I'm going to cross my fingers that this video works. So this, imagine yourself now on vacation in Puerto Rico. It's warm, tropical, it's a beautiful evening, and we're going out on a boat to see the bioluminescence. So this is low light video. You're not going to see color. The boat moving through stimulates these fish. The fish aren't luminescent, but they're swimming through this cloud of the luminescent dinoflagellates. And their swimming action then is exciting the bioluminescence. So you can clearly see the trajectories of the fish, and then anything churning up the water is going to stimulate the bioluminescence. Now they no longer allow gasoline engines in the bay to reduce contamination. But the best thing is to swim in the water. It's warm, it's beautiful. You look up and there's the stars of the Milky Way, more stars than you've ever seen. up in the sky, and then the sparkles of light underneath. So it is really a wonderful place to go and experience the bioluminescence. So please, if you have an opportunity, go to Puerto Rico, and there are other places too that you can go on a tour and experience these wonders. So, places to go. There's three locations in Puerto Rico. This one I was shown the video is from the island of Vieques. It's called Mosquito Bay. I wonder why they call it that. There's a bay, Oyster Bay, in the north shore of Jamaica, which is good, but there they just built a large cruise ship terminal, which may be changing the dynamics of the bay, so we'll see how that affects the bioluminescence. Grand Cayman. There's a bioluminescent bay on Rum Point on the north shore. You can go on a kayak tour there as well. It's really nice. And St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. I'll tell you about my current project working there. This is a new bioluminescent bay, and I'll tell you why that is. But the first bioluminescent bay known from the Caribbean is up here in Nassau in the Bahamas. And this was known in the 1880s as a bioluminescent bay. And it's called Fire Lake. It's Lake Waterloo, which is still there, although it's no longer a bioluminescent bay. This is actually an artificial small bay that was excavated by a rich landowner to stock with turtles and fish for his private consumption. And it turned into a bioluminescent bay, and you can read an account. There's a New York Times article from a journalist who went down there in, I think, 1888, who wrote a New York Times article describing his experience of the bioluminescence. But Puerto Rico really has wonderful bioluminescent bays. There are three main bays. There are several other bays that have seasonal bioluminescence, but these are the ones that are persistent throughout the year. And what they have in common is that they are enclosed with a narrow opening to the sea. In this case, this is a lagoon. The opening is through this channel through the mangroves, which goes to the sea over here, so it's mostly enclosed. And then this is the one on Vieques that we saw the video, narrow opening to the sea. And so probably the retention of water in these bays is important. They're also shallow, and so the entire volume is sunlit. And they're also fringed by mangroves, difficult to see in these images. But the mangrove community appears to be important in providing nutrients for the dinoflagellates to allow them to grow well. And what's interesting is that the luminescent species producing the bioluminescence is the most conspicuous member of the plankton community. It's very unusual that one species remains dominant because you expect that its predators would grow up and just eat it, and then its numbers would go down according to classical ecological theory. So for whatever reason, we still don't understand, one species remains dominant. And so I've worked in one of the bays in Puerto Rico, and what we found, we worked in Mosquito Bay here, and what we noticed that the bioluminescence is pretty consistent, but it can be affected by storm conditions. So when storms, we had two big storms come through, and they knocked down the bioluminescence because the abundance of the dinoflagellate was knocked down, and then a week later, it was back to normal. So it was resilient, it rebounded. What was interesting is during the time of the low bioluminescence, there were other phytoplankton that grew up, took advantage of that, and then a week later, they were gone, and it was back to the normal condition. So it seems like the steady state equilibrium is for this one species to be dominant, but weather conditions can upset that equilibrium. So the concern is with climate change, there's an increased frequency of storms, then that can produce stress on the ecosystem, and maybe the resiliency might be affected, so it may not recover as it used to before, and maybe it'll pass a tipping point, just like, say, there's tipping points for coral reefs. When they become stressed, they become algal-dominated instead of coral-dominated. Well, it could be for these coastal mangrove-dominated associated tropical coastal bays that climate change can produce stress on them and maybe change the equilibrium. So we don't know, but that's an interesting scenario to consider from a scientific perspective. So hopefully we'll have the opportunity to do research on that. But the place I'm working right now is called Salt River in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. Salt River is known as the location of Columbus's second visit to the New World in 1493. He landed here in the spot now known as Columbus Landing. And he was interested in taking some of the locals. That this area was a center of the native population civilization. There was a big settlement over here across the bay. And so they wanted to capture some natives and bring them back to Spain, but the natives were set up and ambushed Columbus's men, and many were killed. So it's sort of an infamous story. But the point where I want to focus your attention is this lagoon over here on the right. So this is the bioluminescent lagoon. And what's interesting about it is that this is artificial. In other words, it was excavated as part of a hotel project some 60 years ago. The hotel project failed, although you can see the ruins of the building. And now, since that time, it just developed, based on natural ecological processes, developed into a bioluminescent bay. And there's a healthy stand of mangroves that are fringing the bay. And whatever these conditions are, it's turned into a bioluminescent bay. So if you actually wanted to engineer, create a bioluminescent bay, you could study this and maybe get some pointers of how to do it. Kind of interesting perspective. So this bay is now, I call it new because it's only 60 years old. And it's now used as a site for ecotourism, that there are kayak tours where you kayak across the bay and in here, and you get a beautiful bioluminescence. So it's really nice. And thing is that this bay is threatened by development. And you notice all this open land over here. Well, there are plans. That land is owned by the National Park Service. And they want to build a marine lab on that land. And in the process, dredge out the bay because they want to allow access to the research boats coming in. So there's a lot of concern of if you dredge out the bay, then what's going to happen to the bioluminescence? You're going to change the conditions. You're going to destroy whatever these optimum conditions are now. Plus, you're going to create a lot of light pollution, a lot of background lights, which is going to ruin the aesthetics of viewing the bioluminescence. So right now, I'm working with a local conservation group in St. Croix to study the bioluminescence with instruments and document the levels of bioluminescence so that hopefully there can be some strong conservation efforts after our study ends to be able to convince the powers that be in the National Park Service, which you'd think would be interested in protecting nature, not being the bad guys, but maybe we'll have some influence on that process. So cross your fingers on that. But this study, obviously, I'm not in St. Croix right now. It's a great place to visit, but I live in San Diego. So in order for a project like this to be successful, then I need the cooperation of locals. So we have a project run by citizen scientists and volunteers, including students. And so they go out on their research vessel, which is a kayak. And here's the instruments and they measure bioluminescence and water quality. And so they go out twice weekly and take measurements, and then those measurements are uploaded to a computer, and then they go up in the cloud where I grab them, access them, and analyze the data. So it's actually a wonderful way to do science, and it's based on a model of what I've done in Puerto Rico. You involve local citizen scientists, you get them interested in it, you train them, they're heavily involved, really passionate about the project, and then you are able to do science. Because this is, the instrumentation is high quality scientific equipment. It's a project I couldn't do myself. And so It helps them, and it's also really interesting science for me. So in my own research, I'm interested in how mechanical forces stimulate bioluminescence, and it's always interesting to consider, well, what do you do with that basic knowledge? Are there applications of the information that we gain? So in my own work, we're inspired by the work of Leonardo da Vinci. This is a drawing he did 500 years ago showing water coming out of a drain, swirling around, and he threw grass seeds into the water to visualize the flow of the water. And you can see all these details of the turbulence in the water. So we were inspired by that and to use bioluminescence as a way to look at, to visualize, to trace the flow of water. And so I want to tell you about one project that we did, and this is to understand the physics within breaking waves. And so this is done not in the ocean, because this is it's hard enough to do in the laboratory, but we do it in a wave tank here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. There's a wave channel, and under computer control, you can generate single waves that break in different forms. You have complete control of that. But the nice thing about it is that you know where they're going to break. And so we have a low-light camera that is on this robotic sled, and it actually follows the wave, because normally waves are moving pretty fast. So here the camera tracks the waves. And the idea is that we are measuring. So we seed the water with the luminescent dinoflagellates, and then we image with the camera how much light is produced. So if you look down here on the bottom, this shows a regular camera image view of a spilling wave. And then with the low light camera, this is showing the bioluminescence that's stimulated by the agitation in the wave. And this is shown in false color. So that's why you're not seeing the true color of bioluminescence. And then through separate laboratory studies, we can essentially calibrate based on how much light we're seeing for a known amount of dinoflagellates of what are the levels of the forces in the water, and then we can get sort of a scale in terms of the forces expressed here as shear stress. So I want to show you a video of the kind of imagery that we collect, and that's on the right, and what you're going to see is a wave. In this wave channel, the wave is breaking, and you're looking only seeing the bioluminescence shown here in false color. So the red will be red hot, so red will be the hottest, and blue will be the coolest. So the wave is spilling and then splashes up. And so from this information, we can actually derive levels of forces. And it's a little more complicated than just the shear stress, because when waves break, they actually entrain an air cavity, so there are bubbles in the waves. So in order to actually figure out the stresses within the wave, then we had to take into account the contribution of the bubbles, which is another order problem. But this is one way in which we can use bioluminescence as a flow tracer to learn about physics, so kind of turning it around. And I also have done a project where we use bioluminescence to learn about flow around a dolphin. And I'll just share with you one video. This is a dolphin. This is swimming off the coast of San Diego and stimulating the bioluminescence. And from these and other images, we could actually look at, based on the bioluminescence pattern on the body, we can draw conclusions about the thickness of the friction layer, about the streamlining on the body of the dolphin. Now, I should point out that this is not a wild dolphin. We tried initially just going out on boats at night and waiting for the dolphins to swim up to the boat, and then we'd film it, and we'd be on watch, and then, oh, there's a dolphin, and jump up and grab the camera. Didn't work. We saw hundreds of common dolphins during the day, and we never got any good video at night. So what we ended up doing to get this kind of footage is to work with the Navy. This is a Navy-trained dolphin, Point Loma. They have a facility and worked with them. And this is a dolphin that we took offshore, and it was freely swimming alongside the boat. A really unique opportunity to get this kind of footage. So I talked about using bioluminescence to learn about physics, ocean physics. And the first application of bioluminescence was actually to measure calcium. That there are some systems in jellyfish where the luciferin and the luciferase are pre-combined, and it just helps the luciferin be more stable so it doesn't spontaneously oxidize. And that's called a photoprotein. And so photoproteins are triggered by calcium. So if you have a photoprotein and you add calcium or a solution containing calcium, you can actually calculate how much calcium is present based on how much light you get through an initial calibration. So that was the first use of bioluminescence. And then another application is using the chemicals or the genes of luciferase and this green fluorescent protein, which is involved in the jellyfish system, using their genes to tell you about gene activity and protein activity. So this photo here shows a tobacco plant. Now, in order to do this kind of markers expression work, you have the sequence of the gene, you introduce it into your organism. So these are transgenic organisms. They're expressing luciferase. And then for the tobacco plant, which is a model for plant research, you actually spray on the luciferin, and then they react, and you get light. So this is demonstrated in 1960 on the cover of Science Magazine. It was one of the first demonstrations of introducing luciferase gene into an organism for research. These cute mice here are expressing green fluorescent protein. Fluorescence is a way of producing light that's excited not by chemical reaction, but by shining like a black light on them. And so but green fluorescent protein is used as a marker for gene expression or protein activity. It's a very powerful tool used in biological research. In fact, if you did a literature search of papers on bioluminescence, you'll get tens of thousands of them dealing with applications involving green fluorescent protein and luciferase. You'll get maybe 100 or so on the ecological value of bioluminescence. So I can't emphasize the importance of these tools in other research. It goes way beyond the ecological aspect of bioluminescence. Bioluminescence is also used as an assay for toxicology. Here's one dinoflagellate that's used. The idea is that you have a control and you have a treatment where you introduce a chemical that may be toxic and you use a decrease or change in bioluminescence as an assay. It's a very sensitive, sublethal assay for toxicity. And I mentioned green fluorescent protein. Its use was so important that the 2008 Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to these three scientists for the discovery and development of green fluorescent protein, GFP. So this is enormous. This scientist, Shimomura, was the one who did the brute force chemistry of isolating this protein from jellyfish. He was at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. He would drive across the country every summer to go to Puget Sound, the Friday Harbor Laboratories, to collect the material, and then bring it back and do all the chemistry to isolate the protein and study its characteristics. Here, Martin Chalfie on the right, he was the one who took the genes for green fluorescent protein and cloned it into other promoter sites of other genes to look at gene expression. So he valued the importance of using green fluorescent protein as an indicator of gene expression. And then Roger Chen here, who is at my home institution, the chemist, he realized that the native green fluorescent protein from the jellyfish it could be better. And that's sort of a common theme in biology systems aren't always optimized. They're as good as they need to be, but they could be better. And so he realized that he could make a better green fluorescent protein, and he did. He made one that was a lot brighter. He made them in different colors, and he had very sophisticated uses, applications of green fluorescent protein in research. So they shared the Nobel Prize. So we're very proud of them. And in fact, in Roger Tim's, in his press conference that he gave when he came back, he thanked his wife for dealing with him because he's a scientist. He thanked the people in his lab for doing all the work for which he was given credit. And then he thanked the jellyfish because it was for them. They're producing this molecule, and we don't really understand all the details of why they have it. So bioluminescence is also a wonderful tool for education, because we're dealing with specializations in physiology, in genetics, in biochemistry, the anatomy of the structures involved, the behaviors, the ecological context for it. There are many different aspects in conservation. I've talked about many different aspects of bioluminescence that you can bring up in an educational context. So it's a wonderful opportunity to engage people in science and just to experience the bioluminescence. This is packets that we prepare, and it's just wonderful to hold it in your hand, shake it up, and see the light being expressed. And here, this is the bioluminescence salon. This is the world, to my knowledge, the world's only permanent live bioluminescence display. It's in Puerto Rico. It's at the Las Cabezas de San Juan Nature Reserve, which is the reserve that surrounds the bioluminescent lagoon in Fajardo in Puerto Rico. And you can go there and go on a tour of the reserve, which is about 300 acres, has seven different types of habitats, including the bioluminescent bay, mangrove forest. It's really wonderful. I encourage you to do that. And as part of that, you'll see the bioluminescence display. And I was fortunate enough to help them develop and implement this exhibit. So, and I also want to point out that the Birch Aquarium has been very proactive in incorporating bioluminescence into their educational programs, and maybe we'll have an opportunity to get something going here at this aquarium. And the last thing I wanted to touch on was bioluminescence as an art form. Hopefully by now you've been impressed with the beautiful photos and at least the videos you could see of the bioluminescence. It's just beautiful expression of light. So I've had a number of opportunities to work with artists, and I want to share with you this exhibit called Carbon 12. And for those of you who read French, it's Art in a Changing Environment. So this is an exhibit that was sponsored by, it was organized through a conservation group in the UK called Cape Farewell, with funding from the British Arts Council. And they commissioned teams of artists to work with scientists to present science in an artistic way in the theme of climate change. So this ran, this is last year, 2012, that it ran. Within an exhibition was in Paris, and so went out for the opening. It's my first ever time participating in an art opening of an art exhibition. And so this shows five teams of artists working with scientists, and I paired up with Erica Blumenfeld, who's a photographic artist. And so we brainstormed on what to do. We collaborated, just like any two people collaborating, brainstormed on what to do, and we came up with two kinds of products. One is these large blow-ups of bioluminescence. This is bioluminescence, and this is 40 by 60 inch size. And for some reason, they like glow. They're not lighting up, they're just seeing it. They're just, anyway, they're just photos. And they're just really spectacular. And if you didn't know that was bioluminescence, what is it? It's beautiful. It's a beautiful art form. And so it's a great opportunity to be able to present this. And so the other part of it was video. And what you're seeing are sparks of light that you're not seeing, But we'll try again. Okay, let's try again. Okay. So what you're looking at is bioluminescence stimulated within a chamber that's agitating it. And this is a chamber that I've used in my own research. In fact, at the time we did this work, we collected this video, I was writing up a manuscript for publication of my scientific study using this same apparatus. And so here, we took the science, this is directly the science, and turned it into an art form. And the other images that you saw of the weird nebulae of the bioluminescence, those were from educational materials that I use. So this is taking materials we already have and applying them for art. So it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to do this. And the last part of the exhibit was that we had a large poster, a wall display, and it made the connection between bioluminescence, the dinoflagellates, phytoplankton in the ocean, and the bioluminescent bays, and the effect of climate change. So there was a science component to it, to educate, and a wonderful opportunity to be able to present my science in an art form. And so here's the latest thing. My latest collaboration is with an LA artist, Glenn Kano, and we are doing something I've never done before, which is a live exhibition of bioluminescence. So this isn't photos or videos, this is the live stuff. This is for GLOW. GLOW Santa Monica is a one-night street festival that is on September 28th, this month. It's at the beach by the Santa Monica Pier. It's held every 2 or 3 years. They get something like 200,000 people showing up. And so you're welcome to join in. And just to give you a little tidbit of what we're planning, it's GLOW. So the name of our exhibit is Wish Upon an Ocean Glow. So we're going to have a bioluminescent wishing well. And so when you make a wish, you'll see some bioluminescence. So it's going to have live material. So right now I'm frantically growing up as much bioluminescent cultures as I can for this exhibit. So cross your fingers, wish me luck. So this is a collaboration number two. So that's what I wanted to share with you today, just to point out that as a marine biologist, I'm extremely lucky that here's the Scripps Pier. Here's my office and lab right here, this building. I've got the best view in the world. And thank you very much for your attention.